joke.
Now all we need to do is record something that doesn't suck. To start recording at like 7 a.m. So we're a little less cynical.
Funny is usually harder.
Funny's way harder. Video works. Audio works.
It's a $3,500 chair.
Woo!
And you are listening to the Think Big and Code Small podcast. My name is Dan Horton, and I am joined with my friend and co-host, Chris Westerhold.
This episode is sponsored by Code Crafters.
Imagine a state where you are completely absorbed in your task, pushing your skills to the limit, yet feeling totally in control and exhilarated. That's the power of deep work and flow state. And how often do you actually feel that way? For most of us, it's hardly ever. Emails, notifications, the open office layout, it's all ruining our ability to have focus. In this week's episode, Chris and I are going to dive deep into deep work and flow state. We're going to cover what it is, why it matters, and how you can use it to increase your overall productivity, whether you're an individual or an organization. It's going to be a good show. Let's get on it.
I sat last night and I wrote till 2 a.m. almost in a journal, whatever journal. I'm not a, you know, 12-year-old girl with a journal saying we need better words, but it's a notebook. And I find putting my thoughts out, it works really well. Whether you look at like morning pages or all these other processes, they say basically get your thoughts out. And I do find it works. And I was trying a 4-notebook system that I was telling you, which was having notebooks kind of focused into things because I wanted to increase my productivity by getting out of my own way. And now what I find is I still haven't really solved the problem. I've just moved it around a bit because now I forget which notebook has which content because I have like 5 Obsidian notebooks. I got like 4 paper notebooks and then work. We use Microsoft.
I'm sorry.
And Microsoft has so many places to put stuff as it is. And everyone's putting things in different places. So now whose notes do I need to work with in what location? And I'm like, wow, this is a cluster. No wonder I have no hair left. Like, this is just crazy stuff. And it's nuts. But I heard from you that you were having a better week than I was from that standpoint.
Yeah, it's been honestly one of the more productive weeks I can remember in a long time. And it's crazy how much you can actually get done when you have a little bit of free time and not just an hour or 2 hours or, you know, hey, I've had a crazy like 4 days and now, you know, you get to Friday, I've got 4 or 5 meetings in the morning and then I have the afternoon off. And it's like, well, you know, is that time really free? Are you in a mental state to be able to leverage that free time? And I would say most of the time, the answer is no.
Right.
And I've had a strangely quiet couple of weeks. We were supposed to kick off a client and it got moved out. So I had a lot of time pushed out to spend the time to kick that off. And I kind of was hiding and like, yes, I have a lot of things that I want to do. And I spent a couple of days like kind of frantically doing the things that I needed to do. And right. I kind of got done with them. And then I was like, well, what do I need to do now? And the chaos had kind of gone away and the thing could, and you know, most of the people thought I was doing the thing that, you know, the client kickoff.
Right, people left you
alone.
And so
people were leaving me alone. And I finally had time to sit back and go, okay, I have time, a significant amount of time in front of me that I can do the thing that would actually benefit me, the company, and everything else. If, you know, with that time, what would I actually do? And I didn't have a great answer. And so I decided to go for a long walk Like I spent it like a day, a couple of days, really, like walking 6 miles and just like letting my mind wander, letting my mind think. And then I come back and I said, I have a whole bunch of like trash decks, a whole bunch of ideas that are half done, things that I've created over the last couple of years that are all just kind of halfway there. And I made the decision that I'm going to go through and rework, rethink, redesign basically all of these things into a good narrative, a good shape, a good design, make them all kind of line up in a way that is going to be really beneficial for me and all the people around me. And it just kind of leans a little bit into what we're talking about today, but I feel like for the first time in a long time, I've been able to actually do deep work.
Yeah. And I, from our discussions this week, I think it's really a good example where you had silence, nobody bothering you. You could kind of focus in, and then you found your state. You found a deep focus, enjoyed the content. The world disappeared for a bit, even to the point you made your comment to me. You didn't even realize what day of the week it was because you've been so into what you were doing and enjoying it that time didn't matter anymore, right? The work was getting done. You felt satisfied. You showed me some of the stuff. You were so excited over what you were able to finally go put together. And I think it's awesome. I miss getting into that state as often as I probably did when I was younger and a developer and some other creative things we did, you know. I know I've enjoyed it when I take my camera out to even go. And it, like to your point, it's why we're kind of going through the topic today about productivity and flow state and deep work and such, because there was a question that was posted out that I reminded me of an old story myself, but it was, why do programmers need private offices with doors? Or nowadays everybody works from home, which is a good question. But the question that was on Reddit, do programmers need private offices? And you know, does that make sense even? I like the question because years ago when I was a programmer, I remember asking my manager if we could, and it's before you could work from home really, if we could, you know, get a room to work on. I was the architect for a bunch of the programs we were running. I needed time to whiteboard and think through stuff, and everybody was in cubes, and every 2 minutes somebody had to pop their head up to ask me a question, ask me a technical question, ask me a business question. I was running a lot of the things we were doing for the department itself. So then you also had business questions, and then you had, you know, pretty much anything that anybody wanted to know. And then you had your friends that would stop by. So, you know, in there, if I was lucky, I got an hour's worth of heads down work. So I'm like, I just need a door. And they would always say no, because they felt like you were trying to level yourself up in the organization. You were trying to act like you were a higher level than you were. And that's the only way they could see it. They never saw it as trying to be productive.
Yeah, it's crazy how many times you get distracted on any given day, especially when you're in like an actual office environment, but even at home. I mean, it happens a lot. And, you know, funny story about the very first time that I ever got an office. So I worked in a cubicle, like just all of us did, especially kind of pre-COVID, for forever. And I finally got promoted and I finally got an office, and it was in a brand new building that this company had just built. And they had, in the design of this building, they had said, oh, well, we're going to put all the offices in the middle. They didn't want the, you know, the corner Locked office the windows. Kind of, you know, thought, even though they still had them. But, and when we moved in, we only moved into these certain floors, and there were certain small offices that were there, and there wasn't enough space for everyone. And so the office, in air quotes, that I got was actually a closet. It had no windows. It had, even the door was like a solid steel door. And when we when we were in there and I was in a cubicle or whatever, like it was literally the closet that they kept brooms and everything else in. And that became my office for a while.
All right.
And I was like, I kind of wanted an office for a long time, but is this really the office that I wanted? And then the funny thing is I was in there for maybe a month and they had run out of space. So then they shoved three other people in this closet with me. And when I say closet, I mean closet. Like it was probably 6x4, 6x5, maybe 8x5. It was tiny. And
when you went in,
you kind of made it right from the door and the wall on the right, there was two people sitting at literally a desk, or it's not even a desk. It was like a table. Like if you were having a gathering in your backyard and you have the table with the little fold out legs, that's exactly what it was. And there was two people on the right and there was another table on the left and there was three people sitting along there. And it's like, I feel like I've been really downgraded. I went from a decent sized cubicle to a closet to now a closet with a handful of other people. It was terrible. And really, in the end, like, that's the only real office that I've ever had.
Wow. Yeah. I've had different locations and some offices that I sat in. It does make a difference to be able to close the door and do that. You and I found some quotes that I think were interesting in that too. And we'll talk about it as we go through. But one of them for our conversation here was from Edward Deming. And he was saying that and asking the question, is this really coming from the systems and processes and methods that we're doing, or is it actually a people problem? Like, is productivity and our lack of being productive based on the people we're working with and around us? So were you unproductive in that office because two people behind you kept bothering you every 5 minutes? Or were you unproductive because, you know, the office itself was like being in a little coffin and you basically couldn't focus and get any work done?
Well, his hypothesis is that 90 to 95% of someone's performance is based on the system in which they work in. And, I really buy into this particular notion, whether it's the work environment or the work system in which you live, we talk a lot about developer experience, but what is the system in which you're developing in, or anything else? I would even make a correlation to things like Formula One, where, you can have a really, really good driver. You can have a high end driver, but if the team and the system in which they're using to develop the car isn't good, then there's just some things you can't overcome. And, to answer your question, it was very difficult to work in that tiny little space with all of those people. And, one of the biggest problems was it was literally just hot. Like,
it sounds
the temperature
like it would be,
in that room was awful, and it you felt like you were in an oven, and so you constantly had to keep the door open. And there was lots of the hallway in which it was in was on the pathway towards the restrooms, so lots of people kept walking by, and lots of people would just stick their head and be like, "Hey, how's it going? Like, how's your closet?" Right.
Check out the people in the closet. Yet. Yeah. Like,
and so it made for a difficult system in which to work because, you had, the three other folks in there with me, three or sometimes four, that you could easily disturb each other because you couldn't even back your chair out of your desk in air quotes without really bumping into the person behind you. And so if anybody was coming in or going, it was constantly like playing this chair shuffle. It was, it really was very difficult to try to get anything done.
Yeah, I could definitely see that. The point he makes, I think, is quite valid, right? Our system processes and methods, like how we work, is more important. I've seen it when organizations are trying to, you know, become agile, and they get an agile coach and they run around trying to change all the practices and processes, and they're not, it's not effective. And then everybody gets upset, and then nothing's working, and then the whole system falls apart. Mm-hmm. And they're paying for that, and it just doesn't work because it was done wrong, right? I've seen that happen. Well, I've lived through a couple of those, and it's not fun. And it's not the people causing the problem at that point. It's actually more of the process itself, you know, starting to cause that issue.
Well, I think that that's a good, like, there's multiple systems in which you're playing. You have organizational level systems. You have kind of boots on the ground development type systems. You have the way the teams work. And one of the, you know, talking about kind of agile transformations, like one of the many challenges that comes with that is you're needing to drive organizational change, the way that the business operates from portfolio and prioritization and those types of things. You're also needing to change the way the teams work at the product or team level. And you're having to change the way that the individual developers work. And those are really three different kind of systems that all interplay with one another. Yet, you know, in a lot of those kind of transformation projects, you're not focusing on all three. Or it's impossible to focus on all three. And so you're trying to change one and it is running into conflict with the other systems that then make what I think a lot of positive changes could be done in, you know, thinking about kind of agile practices at those lower levels. You run into the problems of moving into those bigger or kind of other systems that then just grind everything to a halt, and it becomes almost impossible for it to actually work. And it's why I've seen the vast majority of any company that I've ever worked in that's trying to go through an agile transformation, they almost always fail.
Yeah, I agree. Because a three-legged stool doesn't stand up very well if you only have one leg, or you only, you know, pay attention to one. Yeah. So like you said, people, process, and tech on that. Mm-hmm. That's a good point. Deming had the rule, the 94-6 rule, that says 94% of the problems in the organization are caused by like these types of systems, processes, and such. And only 6% are actually focused on the people. Yet we know, and we've talked about it in other podcasts and videos, is it seems organizations focus more on the people. So it's almost flipped, right? Which then causes a problem.
Well, when you talk about like developer productivity, I think it's a perfect example of saying, you know, we need to be more productive, and they go to literally the end of the line and say, oh, it's your responsibility. Okay, developer, you need to go faster. Right. Like, I know, like, I'm going to totally ignore this whole machine that is grinding through the gears before it gets to you, but you're the one holding the bag at the end of the day, and you need to go faster.
And they're going to put processes in place that measure the person to then say, oh, you're bad at what you're doing. You're the problem. You're slowing everything down. You're the cog in the wheel, where to your point, all the processes and all the other things that are happening before it or around it might be the actual problem. And there's a lot of adjustments that can be made to have a huge increase in productivity as an organization. And it's skipped, missed. We don't look there. We just go to the end. And it's very valid.
And it's you see that in lots of different areas, because it's, you know, it's easy to see the faults of other things or other people or other groups. And a lot of people don't have the ability or the, well, we'll just say ability to self-analyze and see the faults in which, you know, they're kind of producing, and, you know, how they impact the system.
Yeah, but that's the trees and forest thing. So you know, fair is fair. You know, trees and forests, some people don't lift their head up far enough or have the ability to. So we'll be nice about it.
But
in the end, like, you know, you have to live within the system in which you're dealt. And, you know, I think that's one of the reasons.
Or find ways to adjust.
Yeah,
it,
right? Of course. But it's one of the things that drives a lot of attrition. And, you know, you hear a lot about people, you know, people don't quit companies. They, you know, or they don't quit, you know, like what they're doing. They quit companies and they quit managers. I think a lot of this leans into that, because if you're constantly dealing with this, you know, this machine that is just frustrating and all of these other things, even if you love the work that you're actually doing, if the environment in which you live in is so hard to deal with and stress inducing, that you can't ever do, like, get into a deep work state, either you don't feel like you can get things done, you're just going to get frustrated and you're going to leave.
Yeah, caustic environment causes stress, and stress causes people to just complain. And once they're complaining, then they're not focusing on anything they actually need to get done. And you're pretty much in a downward spiral. Yeah.
So,
however, my question, though, like, going from this, my question is, have you had a good scenario? Because I have. I've had many, as well as bad. But I'm curious if you've had a good one.
Of deep work or of which part?
Yeah, of deep work and kind of even the environments we're talking about. So I'll give you one really quick. I worked at IBM, one of my first early jobs. And the building we worked in, they were older buildings. So we hadn't done the open floor plan yet. It was actually up in Endicott, New York. And they had 127 buildings that they bought that were like the street block. So every building on the block was its own independent building, and they just kept buying these little buildings. And then they cut doorways into the building. And the worst part about the whole thing, the only thing that sucked, is as a vendor, I was a consultant for IBM at the time. You had to enter at like the building on the end, and it would take me 20 minutes to walk to where my office was, because I had to walk through all those buildings up and down the floors. And it was good. I was young, you know. But I worked with this older gentleman, and we got our own room. The room was a 10 by 10 room with a door. We both liked to work with the lights off, a desk light on, and our computer as the main light. And we were allowed to set your own temperature in the room. We had all the controls for the office. So it was perfect. I mean, we got so much done because we would basically close the door so nobody talked to us, set the room up perfect, and then both just kind of focus into the work we did. And I would say that would be one of my best examples, I think, where flow state and deep work and everything happened, because there wasn't a lot of meetings. We were programming all the time, and we were just getting good work done.
Yeah, I think that's, you know, I like to think of, there's two different kinds of deep work, as far as I see it, or there's two different ways that you can think about deep work. In my mind, a lot of people think about what you just described as kind of an individual set of deep work. Like, how can I go and get things done in a way, like, similar to the example I gave earlier with these decks that I've been putting together. But there's also the kind of deep work where you're working with other people. And I've had a lot of really great experiences there as well, where, you know, needing to solve a really hard problem, or trying to design something. So, like, a good example is, you know, a year or so ago, we were trying to work on a kind of a new go to market for a product that we were putting together. And, you know, this was, you know, post COVID, kind of, depending on where you were, like, those kinds of things. But we had tried to do work via Zoom in meetings and those kinds of things. And we were just struggling a little bit, because we would spend an hour here, an hour there, you know, and it felt like everything was just taking a long time. And what we ended up doing is, three of us met in San Francisco. We had an office, we had our kind of conference room. We had our own setup. We had paper. Yeah, yeah.
We had whiteboard and some post-it notes.
The whole thing. And we spent 3 days. We basically blocked out our calendar and spent 3 days hammering through, talking, like, you know, almost arguing about certain parts of this and certain parts of that.
I think the word's debating.
Like, yeah, there you go. We were violently debating. But we got more work done in 3 days than we had in, I'm not going to say 3 months, but definitely 3 weeks. And, you know, it really changed the entire trajectory of what we were trying to do. And the ideas that we had about what this thing could look like were completely different after those 3 days. And without that ability for the three of us to get into a deep work kind of mentality, we just would have never been a success.
Yeah. And like you said, you can feel the difference. You know what good feels like, even though we don't get to do it all the time. We know what good feels like. Mm-hmm. We keep saying the word deep work, and anybody who's read the book is going to think we're just talking about the book, but we are talking about concepts from the book, Deep Work, right? And many parts around that. So it probably makes sense for us to just, I guess, explain a little bit what that actually means.
Yeah.
Since we keep throwing the work out, we talk about productivity and we all kind of know that part, but maybe not deep work in itself. Now, the way I understand it is it's pretty much the ability of having, as you said, even earlier for yourself, time that I can be completely focused and absorbed into the task that I need to get done. My brain is not trying. I have no monkey mind. My brain's not trying to go all over the place. The people in the house aren't bothering me every 5 minutes, or in the office, people aren't stopping by every 5 minutes. My stomach doesn't start yelling at me to go get food when I'm not actually hungry because it's trying to make me procrastinate. Or like, you're able to get in this truly mental focus, mental state, because your calendar allows you to have a block of time for it, where you don't pay attention to time. You don't pay attention to anything. Like, hours go by, right? And you don't even know hours went by. That's kind of how I understand it.
Yeah, I would add, I agree with what you just said. The thing that I would tack on top of that is when you're trying to solve complex problems, and from a developer perspective, I mean, there's complex algorithms and now, you know, ML models and all kinds of things that I'm not going to pretend to understand at a really deep level, but they're complex. They're hard. It's a thing that you need to sit and, you know, think about for a minute, like to really kind of wrap your head around how it might work, the intricacies of it, how you might want to change it or think about it or do something different. And you need the mental space to be able to do that. And that, to me, is giving your brain the space to be able to do that is the idea of finding a place to do deep work.
Yeah. When you think about some of the greatest minds in history, right? They were scientists of different types and such, mm-hmm. right? Put into rooms where they could work and think about this and look for connections between things that were never connected before, mm-hmm. ideas, thoughts, concepts, you know, physical things, whatever. And they came up with amazing solutions because they had time to actually think and work through these problems. Almost like you were even doing your deck. When you did your content for your deck you're working on in the beginning, you had a narrative you were creating. Now you just had the ability to take that narrative and go, well, what if? Mm-hmm. Right? And really dive deep and use all of your experience and all of the knowledge you had to decide to poke holes in it, extend it, find connections in places where there weren't, right? Like that, if you never got that piece of work, your story, your narrative, right? Or your design underneath it would never go to the next level.
That's right. And the funny thing is I had 2 or 3 days where people thought that I was doing something else, that I was able to really, really get some stuff done, like a lot. Yeah. And then when I look at things like yesterday and a little bit of the day before, people started to realize that, wait a minute, like you're actually available. And what the amount of work that I got done yesterday was a fraction of what I got done on Monday and Tuesday of Wednesday this week. And what's funny is, you know, I got up this morning and I kind of came down to my office, was drinking a little bit of coffee, and I was, I don't know what day I thought it was, but I did not think today was Thursday.
Yeah.
And it's because I had been in such a flow over the last, you know, 3 days that I didn't really like even the days were just not quite, you know, highlight, like they just didn't seem like, now if I think back, yeah, of course I did the things that I did on Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday, but it felt like it went by really quickly because I was able to get so much interesting stuff done.
And you felt good about what you got done because you felt like you really accomplished something, right?
Yeah.
Not to go off track from it a bit, but you and I have both worked jobs where we were what they would say blue collar, right? Hands-on, did construction. I was an electrician for a while. We did different types of construction. You always went home after the day feeling good because you physically built something, right?
Yeah.
You actually did. You had something you could look back and go, I did that. That was good today. I built this. I installed this. I did this. I fixed it, right?
Well, I think I look at it as a sense of pride almost, where, you know, I would say similar to like our last podcast we put out where, and then we've both said this, like, I felt really good about that one. We were able to spend time to redo the beginning and just really make it a lot more professional. And the same thing applies after you get done doing some of these things. Like I look back at the work I did over the last few days and I feel proud of it because I was able to spend the time, the energy, you know, wrap it up into a nice package and be able to say like, haha, it wasn't, hey, here's another story. It's Tuesday, you know, or whatever. It's Friday. And the sprint ends on Tuesday. You got to get this done. And it's like, nope, go. And just type. Okay. It's good enough. Like, it's probably filled full of bugs, but it's good enough. Like you needed it done by Tuesday. Week. I got it done. Like, you know, a lot of those kinds of things, you don't end up looking back on it and going, yeah, I was really proud of that work because you know, you were under a lot of constraint. You were under a lot of those things and you weren't able to actually give it your best. You were able to give it your best enough.
Yeah. Good enough to get it done, but maybe not enough to put it on your portfolio is the best thing you've ever built, right? The coolest thing you've designed. But
yeah.
And I think, and it brings us into our next part here, next thought process is, because I always think about what's urgent and important and getting stuck on that. We talked about it just between you and I earlier, and days get filled with meetings, days get filled with tasks that feel like they're important, but they're not actually important. So our calendars get filled up, we're working hours, right? And I know for myself, what I find out is, I'm dealing with everybody else's fires and trying to help and coach and mentor and get hands dirty and whatever it takes. But at the end of the day, now I got to go find my time to get work done. Uh-huh. So now I'm spending another couple hours at night. You get it done or you work the weekend. We've all done that, right? You work through a weekend because it's the first time you get some quiet time where nobody's going to bother you. But now you're giving away tons of time where you actually need to unwind. So you're not unwinding. So then there's other problems like no sleep, right? But it builds, it gets bad. I think it's important to understand the different types of work we do so that we understand where or what deep focus is, because, you know, you're not looking to get into a deep focus to go do your emails, you know?
You know, there's a lot of, like, I like the word deliberate when I think about some of these things. And you know, it's hard. We're in a world that there's a bunch of like disruptions that can come up in a bunch of different ways, but you need to be deliberate about how you're structuring your day to be able to get these types of work, the types of work done that you need to get done. You know, another quick example of that is for like I've worked at home. I've worked from home for a long time. And for a while, I was actually, you know, I have a great office at home now, but I was actually spending a lot of time at coffee shops and cafes and those kinds of things. And I would actually go to three or four different places. And it's like, oh, well, I'm at this place. This is where I go to answer emails. This is where I go to communicate with other people. This is where I do that stuff. And I do that, you know, kind of like mid-morning. Then right. I go to another place where I'll have like a little lunch or something, but that's where no one's bothering me. I can go do my deep thinking. I can go, you know, do those kinds of things. And I would go to another place in the, like, and I mean, days would change, but I would be very deliberate on the tasks that I was trying to do in these particular blocks of time. And I like the idea of driving from one place to another because I could mentally disconnect and have a minute to like decompress, almost be like, okay, I am no longer answering every Slack message that comes across or email that comes across or whatever. Like I am now trying to actually get work done.
Yeah. Which is, goes back to what we said in the beginning of processes and procedures and stuff. You created a process that allowed you to manage that state of work, right? You had each one had its purpose. Yeah. I've used time blocking a lot and I have rules for teams, so they understand to work with me, whether it's how to communicate with me or the understanding that I only look at email once a day, if not every 2 days. So if it's important, we shouldn't be living in email. I think it's one of the worst tools ever created. And I would rather somebody call me on a phone, text me, or we use chat, right? Something that makes sense. And I think it's important because you can start managing what you're doing. Understanding logically, the question should be, what kind of task am I trying to do? And is it something that I can be interrupted in or not interrupted in, right? If I'm doing emails, forget about when I'm doing them, but if I'm doing emails, I don't care if somebody interrupted me because I can go back and figure out what I was writing on an email, or if I'm in chats, or if I'm writing a document because I'm doing maybe my report, or I'm building out my notes for something I'm building. Maybe I'm updating my notes for a project I'm working on. Those are things people can interrupt me and it doesn't matter as much, right? But like you said before, if I'm designing the new architecture for some major system, like I don't want to be bothered. Like leave me alone. I have to think. I have to dive deep. Or if I'm trying to debug a system, don't try to talk to me and ask me what the problem is while I'm trying to figure out what the problem is. My short-term memory needs to store a lot of stuff in it so I mentally can picture the entire system I'm working on. So I can picture, literally physically picture in my head, all of the modules and the code and the classes and everything that's happening so I can pinpoint it in this virtual 3D model in my head, you know, and people don't realize that if they don't do it for a living. I need that brain power. Every time somebody comes by, you know, it screws it up. There was a comment that we used to make all the time, which was programming was just like learning another language. If you came up to me and we're speaking English and you switch to German, it's going to take me a minute to switch to German. Well, programming is the same way. If I'm thinking in my programming language and you come up and speak to me in any language, I have to turn that off and change my brain to the next language to talk to you. But I had to turn all the other stuff off. So I've lost it.
Yeah. And there's a couple of interesting stats where, you know, we talk about kind of deep work and, you know, kind of flow state a little bit. Well, it takes anywhere from 15 to 20 minutes to get into a flow state where you can start to do levels of deep work. But then studies also show that we get about 87 interruptions a day, which is
not that much,
about one every 10 minutes,
which is nuts.
And so if it takes you 15 to 20 minutes to get into a flow state and you're being interrupted every 10 minutes, that's a problem. Yeah. It's a problem.
So you're pretty much, if they do the math right, you get like what, 1 hour of focus time or something, but like it's not even together to your point. It's like every couple of minutes. So theoretically, this is why programmers work at night at home or on a weekend or something else, is because during the day, they're not able to get what you're saying here, time to focus, time to work on the actual problem.
Yeah. And, you know, there's one of the, in kind of the developer experience space, one of the things that we are, that I definitely love to track is, you know, uninterrupted time during the day. And so, you know, if you're, you know, well, not if you should be doing some level of surveys, kind of quantitative and qualitative analysis of your kind of overall developer experience. But one of the things you should be talking about is that uninterrupted time, because it gives people the ability to do that kind of work. And you should also be doing, you know, team level and organizational level ways of working to say, okay, everybody, here's what we're going to do. You know, in the mornings, you know, whatever, we can just come up with times. And it's like, look, guys, like no one, like I was doing before with my coffee shops, no one bother me from this time to this time. Like, just leave me the hell alone. Yep. And I know you brought up, I think when we were just chatting, but the old like headphone rule.
Yes.
You know, if you want to, you can go, you can talk about that one.
But. Yeah. I had, I even designed a little tool that I never ended up building, but we were all in cubes. So we created the rule that if somebody was wearing headphones, that meant your door was closed. Basically that was the office with the door and you couldn't interrupt somebody. And then I had the problem from the other side is management didn't like people in headphones all the time. So then we had to have a rule that said you could only have headphones on for a certain part of the day. You couldn't like disappear from the world. So then that allowed us to try to find a happy medium. Later on, I realized in the cube space, it would be really cool if I had a little device that you could put on the corner of everybody's cube and they could just flip an LED to either green or red. So if they didn't want to wear headphones, they could still close their door theoretically by changing the color of this device that would be at the door of their cube. And we were trying to find ways of basically creating a virtual door. And it worked for the most part. And most people found that they were more productive because now they could put music on and they could just go code and nobody would bother them. And then they would put their computers on mute, you know, no chats, no nothing, because that would cause its own problems.
Well, and there's, you know, there's a whole bunch of different kinds of people out there in the world. And, you know, this might surprise some people, but I can get real chatty. And, you know, there's the funny kind of meme that's out there of the person sitting at their desk with the note taped to their back. And it's like, I have no self-control. You know, please leave me alone. I will talk to you for 3 hours and won't get any of my work done. Like that is 100% me. And, you know, because I love, you know, problem solving and those other things. And, you know, I love interacting with people and kind of coaching and all of those kinds of things. So I like that. And so if, you know, people come up to me, like I'm probably going to talk to you and it's not going to be good for me or the things that I need to get done that day.
Yeah, right. And you might help them and we feel good for helping them because I do the same. Yeah. But at the end of the day, you look and you're like, well, I didn't get any of my shit done. Now I got to start my stuff. Yeah.
Well, and in the end, the sad reality is that you don't get any credit for that.
No.
You know, you don't. Most likely, unless you're in some kind of leadership position or something like that. It, you know.
But then the role requires it. It's part of the role. So then that's different. Mm-hmm. But most of the time, and you do get credit for it. Most of the time, the people who give you credit are only the ones that are happy that you've helped them.
That's right.
They're thanking you and they're happy. But yeah, from a larger organizational standpoint, those things are they're required for the business to be successful, but they're not usually visible.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Because you get, you know, your boss isn't, you know, it looks at you and it's like, well, you're not getting your work done.
Right.
And so then, you know, what do you then have to do? You have to then go work at night because you spent 2 hours talking to this person, solving their problem, making their day better. And now you're paying the price in the end because you didn't get your work done. And, you know, like that's a whole different problem. We could talk about it some other time, but it's an issue. And
but you bring up a valid point, right? It's different being remote. But when we were in the office, right, how often and how easy was it just to go over and talk to someone?
Well, there's like the concept of the office wanderer that, you know, just seemingly people just walk around all the time and just want to talk to people. Like maybe they're looking for a, you know, a help with a problem or something like that. But, you know, if you think about the deep work problem, if you think about, you know, the flow state problem, if you think about some of these other things, they're caught, there's wreaking havoc across the productivity. And, you know, there's an interesting stat that I tend to throw out a lot, but, you know, developers can waste up to about 7 hours a week looking for the answers to problems. Then of the expert type folks, the folks that have the answers to the problems, they waste about 10 hours of their time every week. And studies show 40 to 50% of the questions that they're actually asking are relatively redundant, things that they should be able to know if there was a decent set of documentation or whatever. Like, it just, it shouldn't be a problem, but it is.
Right. And so we should just ask Copilot and let Copilot deal with it.
Yeah, sure. I'll knock it right out of the park. But it's a huge problem. And when you think about the productivity loss from something as simple as like trying to get a question answered, it's an issue. And, yeah, you know, you joke about the office wanderer. Like, sometimes they just want to go around and chat with their buddies, or they're in, like, they did a bunch of deep work and now they're trying to decompress, like my driving between coffee shops. Yeah. They're trying to decompress and they're just, you know, they're not hard. Like, they're not, you know, like trying to go like harm anybody. They're trying to actually reset their brain. Yeah. So they went and grabbed a cup of coffee and like, "Hey Dan, how are you, buddy? Like, what's up?" Like, yeah. And it's like, "No, but I was trying to do this thing. Like, leave me alone."
Right. But to your point, you're going to see that person, you know, and you'll be, "Oh, yo, yeah, how you doing?" You know, like, how, and they're like, "Oh, I just got this great piece of work done and I did all this." And yeah, next thing you know, 20, 30 minutes go by and now you're like,
"Catch the football game over the weekend."
Now you're like, "I got to go to a meeting. I just lost my window. I had to do my deep work." Yeah. Cause that happens often for me throughout the years, I guess I would say, is not so much the interruption in that way, but you end up in a chat or a meeting runs over or somebody stops by and needs help and you block the window. And this is the problem of not being good at saying no sometimes, that people should be better at saying no, right? You want to help somebody. Next thing you know, you blocked out your window and then you didn't use it, right? And then, like, I think it's a good example, I guess, or a reminder that it's important to manage that for yourself and say no, like learn to say no well.
Yeah.
Well, as you and I laughed about, it's easier to do what I say and not as I do. So I coach everybody to do that and then don't do it for myself. And
it's so kind of funny. So hard. But in the remote world, you know, we joke a little bit about the office wanderer, but now in the remote world, you have things like Slack and all of these other electronic notifications that, you know, I mean, every time, like, I mean, in our field, I use Slack, we have GChat, we have Teams, we have all kinds of stuff depending on what client I'm working for. But it seems like every time I get an email in one of my 6 email addresses, my watch vibrates, my phone goes off, my iPad blinks, like, it, you know, it is becoming harder and harder and harder to get away from some of that kind of stuff.
Yes, 100%, right? As we're talking here in the corner of my eye, I keep seeing my phone turn on and off because I know it's showing me a notification for a chat or an email popping up on the front. I turned a lot of notifications off, but some of them, like you said, we have to keep them on because there's reasons to catch those. But it's hard to turn stuff off. I don't feel comfortable at night putting everything on do not disturb. Right. Though that's what we should be doing during the day. We should be putting a lot of our systems on do not disturb and just working. Because if we were in a paper office, we would automatically get that. You know, you close your door and then you were disconnected. If you didn't answer your phone, you were fine.
Well, I mean, I remember back when cell phones weren't a thing.
Right.
Like, you know, I mean, you left the office and you were done. Like, there was literally nothing you could do until you walk right back into those doors. And right. I think this is one of the biggest challenges of working from home. And I know what it's been for me, is, you know, for a long time, there is no separation between work and home, really. Like,
right.
I have a really great office. I've got a great TV. I've got a couch right behind me. I get all of these things and I work at this desk. And then a lot of times at night, I just sit on the couch right there. And so there's nothing, there is no physical separation at all from work to home. And so seeing a notification makes me, I can just jump.
Yep. And I know myself, I end up where, like you said, you have access to everything you need in one room. I'll end up finding some days where I'm in this room all day long and just short of going to the kitchen to get food or a drink and coming back. I live here until I go to sleep just because there's so many things that we do because we're home, whether it's work, whether it's not work, but it's all in the office, right? It's all in the one big room here.
Yeah. And you've kind of built your own little prison.
Yeah. I was going to say it's a bad thing. You and I were talking the other day too, because I needed to think about something and the space was not working for me. So I literally got in the Jeep and I drove around the block and I set my phone up to record me just talking. And I was able to solve my problem in like 15 minutes of a drive because I just changed my location and my mode of working, but it allowed me to be productive again. Like, there's a lot to be said for being in an office sometimes or being in different locations. I've done the coffee shops, like you said, for certain tasks. How do you find how do you block deep work, but then how do you find, right, a flow state? We mentioned flow state as well.
And well, this really leans into flow state because, you know, having, like, there's a couple interesting things about kind of flow state, and it has to do with, like, I think of deep work as being able to have the time to be able to get to there. But, you know, I think flow and deep work, they all kind of align together. But if you think about like a flow state, it's hard to get into a flow state if you have high levels of kind of anxiety, whether that's stress or, you know, like I know you've been going down the, you know, like the paper road. And so you've got a bunch of post-it notes all over the place and which is great. Like in a lot of ways, if you're in that mode, it's like, oh, it's awesome to have all of that. But when you're trying to get into a flow state in something else and trying to do something else, looking around and seeing all of the stuff that's there is probably like a little anxiety, like anxiety kind of builds up. It's like, oh my gosh, there's all this stuff. Like, oh God, what do I, like, shit? Like, what do I do?
Yeah, and it's true because it can cause more stress. For what you're talking about, I found works for me is the whiteboard I'm doing right now is I bought a giant 3-foot roll of construction paper, I guess I would say. It's, you know, just plain brown paper. And I tape it on the wall and I do all of my work on that piece of paper. It allows me to get into a really nice flow state where I'm really focused in what I'm doing. Gets me off the computer, away from notifications, away from chat and everything else, email. And I get a lot done really quickly. And then when I'm done, I actually fold it up and I put it on the side so it doesn't stay on the wall. Or I tape another piece of paper on top of it that's blank or something else, you know, to try to hide it. And it gives me somewhat the best of both. Because like you said, if you leave everything everywhere and it's messy, that is a that can be a danger in its own.
Mm-hmm. Well, it just makes it, I know for me, it makes it hard to focus. And you can, you know, we've talked a lot about interruptions of meetings and Slack messages and everything else like that, but you have mental interruptions as well. And I think that's what we're leaning into here is like, oh man, oh, I got to get this other thing done. I got to do this thing. I got to do that thing. I got to, man, sometimes your brain wants to fight you on like, this is the thing that I know I need to do. And I've got to focus on it. Like, I've got to get this done. But in the end, like your brain's like, no, but you also have these other things that you got to do that might be bringing you pain or anxiety or fear or sadness or whatever that, you know, are causing those issues as well. And that's blocking your brain from really diving deep into a problem.
Yeah. 100%. And, sometimes you have to figure out how to deal with those things first before you can get into a flow state, because you can get, I guess it goes back to something what I said earlier, right? I can block out time for deep work, but if I'm feeling stressed for work, like something needs to be done, there's a bigger priority, a bigger issue or something else, that's going to take priority. So then I'm going to use that block to deal with that stress or that aggravation or that concern or, you know, anything else. And what's going to happen is I'm going to use up that block for other things that might be important, but they're not allowing me to take care of something that is also important, just not urgent at the moment. And thus is making me maybe theoretically less effective overall, because I'm not able to work on something that could have a higher impact long term. Right. And so it's, it is important to try to find how to limit some of those things, or at least get your brain away from them for a while. Right. You have the idea from David Covey's GTD, which is, you know, creating lists. And he says that if you write everything down on paper, you can get it out of your mind. Doesn't mean you fixed it, but at least you know where to look for it when you want to remember all the things you're supposed to do. It's like when they used to tell you before you go to bed, right? Write down everything that's in your mind before you go to bed, so it doesn't wake you up in the middle of the night.
Yeah.
And I like that idea, and I've used it for years, because if I write it all down, then hopefully it's not in my mind. And then my mind is free to do this work when I give it the time to do this work.
That's right. I you know, there's a big push for developer productivity right now. And one of the things that I always, you know, challenge leaders with is, you know, you can't do developer productivity to your community. You need to do it with them. Because if you do developer productivity to them, you are going to increase levels of anxiety and all of these other things that is actually going to be counterproductive to what you're trying to do. Like, you're trying to, you know, to make things more productive, but people are looking at it as you're trying to, you know, squeeze every ounce of juice control out of the lemon.
Yeah. And it's like management control is what's going to be looked at.
Yeah. It can be, you know, really, really detrimental. But the one thing that I can't quite figure out is, and I can't remember who actually created, who came up with flow state. I don't remember.
Yeah, you're just having fun because we both tried to say the name and neither of us were both. So I think it's Mihaly, I think is the way the name is.
Yeah, I think that's their first name, but I can't remember the last name.
what is it? Csikszentmihalyi, I think is what it was. And I'm going to put the audio into our audio here later for that. But the both of us were so afraid of screwing this up. Because the guy's got a name that's not for us a normal name, right?
It is it's a thing, and I can't even. I've tried like six times to try to pronounce it, and I am sorry, the creator of Flow that, you know, popularized this. I'm very sorry. I can't say your name. But you did a good job. Right? I really like what they put together on it, though.
Yep, I agree with you. Both of us. It's like, wow, that's a hard name.
But to go back to, like,
I got enough problems just saying normal words half the time, let alone trying to say, you know, certain last names and first names.
Yeah. To go back to the original question of, you know, should developers, you know, do they need an office with a closed door? I think it, to me, it really goes into like kind of office design. And I know there's a lot of people working from home, but there's also a lot of people getting pulled back into the offices. And I think we need, or well, I'm not going to state that with my opinion, but, you know, what do you think about kind of office design in general, and how does that impact deep work or really flow state or anything like that?
Well, it's an interesting question, right? Because the idea originally was open floor plans, because it was supposed to make people collaborative, right? Or collaborative. And yet that didn't happen. And you had people still asking for private spaces to work. And then even in one of our buildings before, you ended up with the, what were they called? Like the little cubby holes.
Right? Oh, yeah.
And that was to try to create office space now, because there was no no privacy, no quiet time or no space, or you left the building to go work somewhere else because you tried to create your own, you know, private space to work. It was, I think it's a good question. I'm trying to not give a blunt answer, I guess, because
I'll be a little more blunt.
I personally open offices think they're useless. Awful.
Yeah, they are terrible in every way. You look in there, they're loud. I remember I worked for Optum for a while, and they had a tech building up in Minneapolis that I went to, and it was three levels. It was kind of a big kind of rectangle, and in the middle of it was open. So you could kind of see all the way down to the first floor. The first floor was completely like tile. And then on each, like they had these sections and there was just these long rectangle tables that would hold 15, 16 people. And anywhere you stood in there, it sounded like you were in the busiest airport you could possibly imagine. It was so loud and there was no way to get away from it. And it was a visually very nice building. You walk in, you're like, wow, this is actually really nice. Like it's aesthetically pleasing, but there was nowhere to hide. And even the offices and conference rooms all had glass doors.
Yeah.
And so you could see into everywhere. There was nowhere to hide from anybody for anything. And I absolutely hated it. And everybody there hated it. And so what ended up happening is everybody always tried to find places to hide. Everybody would have headphones on. Everybody would just try to find any way that they could go or hide or do to be productive. And it was impossible.
Yeah. I was in a couple offices. I'm thinking of one that I was in that looked beautiful, to your point. It was 5 stories, I think. You could see down the center, same kind of idea, same layout, like you were saying, even as the offices were against the walls and they didn't want to block the light, so they made everything glass. But now you could see everyone in the room and you could see what they were doing and what they're working on, and you could check out the whiteboards they were doing. And there was chairs everywhere to just stop and work. Kind of more like a hotel in some areas, maybe.
Yeah.
People were trying to find spots to work so people would leave them alone. Or I know, like myself, I'd often leave the building just to go someplace where nobody knew me so they wouldn't bother me. And the noise was more white noise, not hearing people talking about things for work that might actually distract me from trying to think about work. You know, it's a real thing. And I don't think I've worked someplace where I've seen that be a positive environment.
So I found a study, and a study of 10,000 workers, 95% of them said working privately was important to them. Only 41% say they could do so. And 31% said they had to leave the office to get work completed.
There you go.
Like, okay. if that's, you know, if 40% of your, you know, of your workforce says that they could actually get private space to do work, that means 60% of them don't.
Right.
And the 31% of the people that had to leave the office were probably working from home in the evenings, taking time away from their family and everything else like that, that because they couldn't get their work done during the day.
Right. And they're still being responsible and they care. So they are part of your culture. They're part of your organization. They care. So they're doing the work on their own time, but it's going to take away from work life. They're going to get frustrated at some point and they're either going to leave or they're just going to end up complaining, and that hurts your culture and then destroys the company anyway. So like there's a downstream effect to all of this that is not positive, right?
Well, here's another interesting statistic. So, and in another survey by the New Yorker, a whopping 62% more sick leave was taken when open office plans were instituted at a company.
And I don't think it's because people were getting sick.
I don't believe so either. Like if you have a table of 16 people literally facing each other 3 feet apart, like you're probably going to get more like actual sick.
Yes.
But at the same time, people, I think people are just like,
wanted to work from home. Oh man, or
I'm
something.
Not feeling great. I'm going to work from home today. Like right. I need to get, you know, I've got to get things done.
Right. I actually had work done. Like,
yeah.
Yeah. All the tables that we've run of all the teams, right? There's good team building of having everybody there and working together, let's say, at the big tables, and helping each other once in a while with questions and stuff. More often, I felt like they would do better if they were left to just go work on their own, right? The table was great for some things, but I don't think it was great for others. It also allowed for certain amounts of general chit chat and collaboration and screwing around, like, you know, yeah. I mean, you need some of that, but how much of that made them less productive? Again, where if you just let people work and trust them and let them get it, let stuff get done, you know?
Yeah.
I understand floor space in a building though is expensive. And by keeping it open, I have more creativity in how I use the space. If I close it up and try to create offices, either everyone's in the dark because they're all in a closet, like your closet, or, you know, they have to be a mix of cubes and offices so that, again, I try to optimize the space that I have and let some light into the building and things like that. So, and it's expensive, like I said, no matter what. So does it make sense to do that? Or do we actually look at having a different format, something that works better, right? A different way, like you said, different ways of using an office, of laying it out, right? We can architect a different solution, whether it's a building in itself or even the layout of how it's being used.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because you need all of those different types of spaces. Collaborative space is good. But in the end, you know, you have to give people time to do their own work and to be in their own space. And, you know, as many companies are now asking, i.e. telling people they're coming back into the office, I think this has to get resolved in one way or another of, you know, how do you re-architect your buildings and lay them out differently where you can allow people to do the things that they need to do and give people the ability to collaborate and do those other things that are just as valuable in certain times and certain spaces. And I think it has to get, we have to do that if we're going to continue to be successful, because the amount of time that is wasted, and I don't have a number on this, but has to far, far, far outweigh whatever cost benefits there are of, you know, reconfiguring an office building.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. A lot of recently, I've been in a lot of conversations where people are asking, how do I use the space and get my employees back in? Like, I want to bring them back in, but I'm not just forcing it, because then people are gaming the system anyway. So it's still useless. They're not using the office. So the question becomes, you know, what does that look like? Like, I want people to have an outcome of why they're going in there. They're going to the office to specifically do something. Either, like you said, I'm coming in to design and whiteboard and do some ideation against a certain problem to come up with a solution as a team. Or we're doing some team building or something else. There's something specific for a project you're working on, and that's a reason to be in the office. Now, that makes the space useful. If we take that concept and go further, there's an architectural design form, right, called form follows function, which the things that are built are built. The shape that we're building is determined by the function of how we're going to use it. Mm-hmm. If we follow that model, which I guess in some ways even touches on Conway's law from a design side, right? So that always comes up. And you came across an interesting thing that I hadn't heard of before. And it was, let me see if I can say it. Is it eudaimonia? Maybe?
Eudaimonia?
Yeah.
I mean, we're really machine? Good at English. That's the one thing that we've definitely learned today. That,
yes. This is not our
our strongest suit.
No. I can write with all the big words because I don't have to say them. When I have to say all the big words, then I don't want to use them.
I mean, it's a Greek concept. So I think we're going to say that that's a Greek word, and I don't know Greek. So that's my excuse and I'm sticking to it.
There you go. What I liked about it is the concept of spaces for purpose, for outcome. Right. And you, and I'll pick off the first one and we can go down a list a little bit because I think it's important for people to think of it. And one of them was the gallery, which was basically the opening when you come into the building, right? They still say the first room when you enter coming off the street, we call it the gallery. The room contains examples of the work that's produced in the building itself. It's supposed to inspire users when they come in. I know back when I was going to school for architecture, I designed my own building, or if I had my own architectural studio. And what I did was the first room of the building, without even knowing this design, but the first room of the building had 3D models of all the buildings we created because I wanted customers coming in to be inspired by the work we had done before. So I think that's a great idea.
Yeah, I agree. And, you know, each individual space needs to bring out a different kind of set of emotions and have that kind of physical barrier along with emotional barrier between the two. And, you know, like this next one, like they call the salon, and it's really a place of kind of curiosity and almost like arguing concepts and debating. And, you know, how it's the, I kind of look at this one as almost like the pub.
That's a good way to think of it, right?
Let's go grab a pint and you know, argue about this particular topic and see where we can land on a good idea or a different way of thinking. And it's a space that allows for that. And if you're in this space, like this is the place in which you can go to do that. And you know, one thing that I will mention here is it, like, you know, yes, you can have these individual spaces, but you also need a culture that allows people to be able to do it. But we'll get to that in a second.
Correct. It has to support it, right? 100%. And maybe this is something we come back and we talk about culture a little bit more and pop this in here, because it'd be interesting to see what does it take to change a culture or to align your culture to use these things. Because salon, as you said, is almost like the concept of the open kitchen that is sitting in a lot of offices today. Mm-hmm. They expected people to go to the kitchen, get some coffee or food, and then start talking and designing and you know, basically getting help from each other because you happen to be in this open space.
Yeah.
It happens for some companies. It doesn't happen for others, but that was the idea.
Well, I would say that a lot of them aren't designed that way. Like even if like we've built a really nice looking coffee bar, there's no whiteboard there. There's no like mechanism to be able to do some of those things. Like we can come here and it's, you know, it's almost just like, no, it's just this little coffee station.
Yeah. It's a cafeteria.
Maybe there's a couple of chairs sitting there for you to sit down and drink your coffee. Like, okay, well that's fine, but that's not a place. It's usually wide open. And so there is no physical separation. So if you're going to argue in air quotes with somebody about an individual topic, a guy like me, I can really, like, I have to really be careful because I can speak very loudly.
Right.
And the more I get excited about something, the more my kind of volume goes up. And I'm not doing it on purpose. It's just, you know, and if you're in an office and you're having a intense conversation about a topic, you might be bothering everyone on that floor unless there's some kind of physical separation.
Yeah. I went and I talked to Exxon once. I think I'll do that. And I like their campus they had. And in the campus on the basement is where they had like coffee and shopping. And it was the old school format of a true campus where you could get your laundry done. You could do some shopping if you forgot stuff that you needed, like at a CVS kind of idea, things like that.
Yeah.
That I thought was great because that and the coffee shops in the buildings were put into areas where you truly were outside of the workspace. So if you had all these discussions, if you were making all this noise, you were you were in a more comfortable space. You could make all the noise and everything else, or you could walk outside into the campus if the weather was nice enough, mm-hmm. and you could do the same thing. It was a beautiful mm-hmm. design campus. And I always had liked that. Years ago, even IBM old campuses I was on, they were trying to have that kind of format, you know, back in the day when campuses was a thing for organizations.
I was at a Google building in Zurich, and, you know, they had a coffee shop there. They had like kind of bean bags and like little like windowsills that you can sit on. And you could just go in and get coffee, like any regular person going to get coffee. But then there was areas that you had to be a Google employee to get in to, and that you could see that there were still these individual areas, and they had whiteboards and that you could tell it was still in this open, like the space that was relatively loud, but that was definitely an area that feels like what this should be is, oh, go grab a coffee, go grab some food, go grab whatever, and have as, you know, energetic of a conversation as you want to, because it's just kind of loud in here anyway, because, you know, there's the coffee shop, there's a sandwich shop, there's these other things, and, you know, you can do what you want. That kind of leads to the next one, which is the library, right, which is the exact kind of opposite of this one. Yep. Where it's like, I am trying to, like, I need to go get information. I need to do research. Maybe you can come tap on my shoulder here, but like, I'm trying to be quiet. I'm trying to do things, and I need to figure out and gather information in a more, you know, honed down kind of way. Like,
yeah,
you know, whisper in the library, please.
Yeah. I think it's important. I know, as you said before, you went to different locations. Even in my own house, I have a spot where I read books. And if I'm in that spot, my brain knows, oh, we're focused for reading, and it allows me to process data differently than if I'm sitting at my desk here. Mm-hmm. There was a client I went to, and it was the coolest office design I've ever been at. And they had hidden rooms. The rooms were hidden in the rooms like an old school TV show that you had to know the combination of things to click to open a hidden door, and there were quiet rooms behind it. And those rooms, you could go in there and you could sleep for a minute or you could read, but there were quiet hidden rooms in the office itself.
Love it.
That was the coolest design. So one of them was a hidden room off of a little quiet library. You go in a library and it looked just like a library kind of set up, books everywhere and a table in the center and some lamps. And then behind one of the bookshelves was a door that went to a quiet room. And it was perfect. And when you walked in there, you felt like you could sit and read and research. And
yeah,
that kind of a format, I feel like, would almost make people want to use it for that reason.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's a, you know, being able to kind of quiet your mind.
Yeah.
And when we talk about the noise and those kinds of things that come from an office, and being able to quiet your mind and, you know, research and absorb information can be really, really difficult sometimes. And that's always a struggle.
But it is required in what we do for a living. We're knowledge workers.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, it's, you know, doing some of these things is tough. And the next one is just, you know, basically a conference room, which is great. Like, you know, hey, you shouldn't be yelling and screaming in here, but you can do your, you know, your meetings. But then the last one I think is super interesting, and they call that chamber.
Yeah, I'm 50-50 on this one, because we've had those in some of the other buildings that we've worked in. And it's kind of like an old phone booth without the phone in it.
Yeah.
And it's too small. I feel like I'm back in your closet you worked in. Like, yeah. The walls are too close. There's no view. It's to me, that isolation is a little bit more like I've been put in a white padded room, and not so much like you gave me a place to think.
I've been in an office that has some of these. The notes that we found, it says to be 6 by 10 feet, which, you know, protected by soundproof walls. I've never seen one 6 by 10 feet. That's an office.
Yeah, that's an office. That would be different. That would be a little easier because you have some breathing room.
Yeah. What I end up seeing is like, there's one company I can think of that I've been to. They're a big rock. But they have these, hotel is the word that I hear used a lot. They are tiny. It is like an airplane seat with walls around it. And there's a glass, like a little glass door. And you can't even like chicken wing your arms inside of this thing.
Yeah.
And it is soundproof, but the problem is that the soundproofing brings a lot of thermal insulation. So if you sit in there for more than about 15 minutes, it is a sauna.
Right. And now you're sweating, you're uncomfortable, you don't hear anything, you can't move.
And I'm not the tallest guy in the world either. I mean, I'm 5'11"-ish. And I can't stand up in it. And so you basically have to sit. And like, it's not quite as small as an airplane seat, but it's like a first class airplane seat. Where like you kind of have enough room to do a computer, but you're still kind of T-Rexing your hands a little bit. Like it's not great. Not great.
It just that design and most of them we've seen doesn't match what we're reading in this document here. The room a little bigger would be better. I was just at a WeWork and the WeWork had a format that was a little bit more. It was kind of like you stuck two bench. It was like a bench setup. It was like two benches and a table in the middle turned sideways and stuffed into a phone booth. And it was a little better, I guess, because it was a little bigger and two people could work in there. But I don't know. For me personally, I feel a little too cramped into there. I'd rather go sit outside in the middle of a lawn somewhere and work where there's nobody around me.
Well, that Optum building I talked about earlier had those. And what actually ended up happening is depending on what time you got there in the morning, all of those would fill up. And so you couldn't use them for an hour or whatever. People would just be in there all day. And you couldn't book them as a conference room. You couldn't anything else. And so there's people that would have second monitors in there and it just became their own little.
They made offices out of it.
Yeah. They made offices out of them and it was first comes first serve. So you had to get there super early to get one.
Yeah, it's again, like we said, gaming the system. Everybody figures out how to always game the system.
Yeah. But I've actually had, you know, this goes a little bit back to my coffee shops, but I've actually had a lot of luck kind of working in public.
Mm-hmm.
It's weirdly not distracting to me. You'd think being in an office space where you know everyone can be distracting because they can talk to you and whatever. But sitting in a coffee shop, you know, like music playing, people around, like I can weirdly get into a flow.
Yeah, me too. It's almost like that's more white noise and you know no one's going to talk to you.
Yeah.
But you have the expectation of environment because you know no one's going to talk to you. I also have, to your point, I have a bunch of places I eat. Near me here, I have a connection to Wi-Fi for all of them and they expect to see me every once in a while because I'll go work there for a couple hours. Like I'll go for dinner and I'll bring my laptop and I'll work while I'm sitting there eating.
Yeah.
And I'll just go to the bar and I'll sit there. The funny thing, funny, not haha, but funny in general, I guess, but to what you just said is I know the owners of a lot of the places too, because I've been eating there forever. Now they come out to hang out with me and talk. So then the laptop never opens.
Yeah.
Because now I lost that, the expectation of the environment has changed, right? I've lost that ability to go there and work focused because now somebody wants to interrupt and talk. And I'd rather talk and socialize a bit since we do work from home and I never see real people. But, you know, it's kind of nice.
How many real people are you keep talking about? All I see is talking heads on screens.
Exactly.
I don't think there's actually people in the world anymore.
No, it's all virtualized now on the screen.
But, you know, I've actually had that problem as well with a couple of the coffee shops. Cause I mean, you know, like I'm a chatty guy. But you know, it also comes down to like setting your ways of working as well, whether you're in an office or whatever. And it's like, you know, people love to chat with you, but it's like, hey man, like, oh dude, hey, like Like, let's chat in a little bit. You know, you got, hey, man, exactly. You got time in an hour? Like, I'd love to grab a beer or a coffee or whatever. Like, but something simple as that is, you know, you're not saying like, hey, man, leave me alone. It's, you know, set a time into the future. And even if you know you're going to leave in an hour, kind of a little bit of a dick move, but it's like, hey, dude, oh man, sorry, bro. Like, I gotta go. Something came up. Like, let's chat tomorrow. Like, or I'll be back in a few days. Like, let's sit down and I'd love to hear how you're doing.
Yep, exactly. Well, even the places I eat at, one of them, the owner and I talk all the time, really, really good conversations, really great guy. And if I go in and I really got to get something done, I just tell him, I'm like, I need to focus on this first and get this done. And I'll sit at a table instead of the bar.
Yeah.
So I change the format. And by changing the format, they talk to me for a couple minutes in the beginning, but then they leave me alone the rest of the time I'm sitting there. But that's if right. I sit at the bar side of it, they know that I probably brought it just in case there was nobody to talk to, but they know I'm probably not going to open it. So then they just, you know, hang out and talk.
That's right. I mean, and at least they're going to bring you a coffee or beer or
by then it's usually nighttime when I'm working. So it's a beer. Yeah.
Yeah. Can't go wrong there. But I think I think all of these are all valid problems, but like, how do you actually go about trying to solve any of these is a thing. It's a challenge.
I think the one I'll start out with that we just brought up in our conversations here is, from my own examples, is getting better at saying no to your time blocks. Great time blocks, right? If you go look at big rocks, right? Franklin Covey's stuff is find your big rocks and block them on your calendar before the week starts and then don't move them. Like, those are your times to have focus. And then off of that, be better at saying no so that you can spend time working on those important pieces. And if you can, get management support to help you to keep those time blocks.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I would advocate for this for everybody, and everybody understands the value, but I see very few people do it. Or is do a ways of working session. Whether it's with your like engineering team, whether it's with your kind of product team or however your organization works, and you know, up to me, you know, even your engineering director, whatever, hey, can we spend a little bit of time, like an hour, and come up with ways of working that is going to help drive everything forward? And, you know, ask questions like, you know, is it okay for me to go on do not disturb when I'm in my, like, okay, we've right. decided between 9 and 11 every morning, we're going to do our stand up at 8:30 from between 9 and 11 every morning, where we're going to do like, that is 2 hours of dedicated morning time.
Right. No meetings,
just leave me the hell alone.
Yep.
And it is okay for you to go on do not disturb and go right. And then you can do your, do your lunch or whatever after that. You know, I'm not telling you how to live your life, but come up with those ways of working. And, you know, like everything, I see so many people complain about a lot of things. It's like, oh, well, you know, there's a joke like, hey, I don't need you to move my damn card on the Jira board. Like that kind of stuff. That could all be solved in these ways of working. It's like, yep. Look, like, hey man, like don't touch my shit. Like, or whatever, right? Like just come up with remove those little annoyances, figure out how you can work and then go from there. Like, I don't think we're going to solve the office challenges. I mean, but you can solve these other little challenges that are going to significantly improve your day to day.
I think even the office challenges can be fixed in certain ways. Like I was saying, being able to come up with ways of people marking that they're in a do not disturb state. If the design of the office doesn't support having some of these cool little offices and some of these spaces, right? Yeah. The other is to look at creating them. If you're leadership or, you know, the owner of the organization, you can look to try to create some of these things. It might be a reason that someone wants to come back into the office.
Yeah.
They want to use these services. They want to have the ability to do some of these things, but that has to also be matched to changing the reason why they go into the office. It's no longer to show, it's no longer a metric. So I can say that I know you're working because you're sitting at your desk, right? That's no longer a thing. Yeah. But I do want you to come in and make an outcome an output that's coming. So if the team comes together to brainstorm and we've moved something forward, perfect. The space paid for itself. You know, the people did their job and everybody's happy. Like there's, you can set goals, you can set priorities and outcomes that allow you to get value out of both these changes and the space itself.
I agree. And, you know, even down to like the physical barriers, like even if you have three 16 person desks, you could say that desk is the desk to leave me alone. Like I need to get stuff done. Like if I'm sitting at this desk, leave me alone.
Right.
And I need to get something done. If I'm at, you know, and you know, similar to my coffee shops again, like you can just eat, you know, you have the different definitions for each of these, figure out ways of, you know, okay, well the team is going to have this room and you know, you can get, you can have it for these 2 hours. You can have it for these two, whatever. Like there's a whole bunch of creative ways you can think about it, but it's all about just setting expectations and figuring out the ways that you can work together. So many times I hear people just bitching and complaining about how everything works, yet they've never actually talked to everybody about how it actually works. And a lot of that can lead to micromanagement. It can lead to all of these other problems that everybody wants to complain about. But, you know, in the absence of an answer or in the absence of a standard, people will make their own and it will probably be different than what you come up with. And you've now created this kind of false, like, conflict that doesn't necessarily need to be there because you probably could agree on a common thing pretty easily.
Yeah, it is where the, like you said, the ways of working really comes in handy, getting people on the same page. I think the point to where we've gone with all of this is that this is important, right? If you want to create high quality work, high quality outputs, you want teams to be high performing teams. You want to solve real problems. You need to have focus time. You need to have time to work, to get into flow states, to look and figure out how to work with complex problems and issues. That means we need to actually look at our space we're in and we need to change how meetings are done or handled, right? How time is handled, the expectations of the culture itself, that people don't get in trouble for not attending every single meeting. They should be able to pick which ones are the most important and not. Also, the culture should maybe look at not inviting everybody to every meeting. Like that's kind of a problem.
Yeah. Well, and also treat people the way you want to be treated. Like, I know that's like a fourth grade, like, you know, four-year-old, like, that kind of teaching, but, you know, everyone has this, like, and I know, like, I've fallen guilty of this, of like, well, I have this problem and I need it solved, like, right now. Well, it's like, well, yeah, but that other person's busy trying to do their work and you, you know, well, yeah, everybody else should leave everybody alone, but this is actually important. So I'm going to go bother somebody, even if it's in the middle of their deep work time. And it's like, no, that's not acceptable. Like you can wait. It's not like the world's not going to blow up between, you know, now and 11:30 or whatever. And it's going to be okay. And there's other things that I'm sure you can do, or maybe there's other people you might be able to leverage to solve the problem. Not just running to your tech lead or to whoever every time and whatever, like you have to respect the boundaries. So people will respect your boundaries.
Yeah. And I think it's a nice ending to this, right? It's that lead by example, right? We whether you're doing it on the team, whether you're trying to make changes or whether you're the leaders trying to put this in place, is you find ways to do this yourself and also helping teams to figure out how to work and make those changes and then provide environments that are a safe place to test this and learn and do it. And it's only going to benefit the team and the organization.
That's right. And, you know, there's no right or wrong answer to any of this. But it's all about culture, trying to get the best out of people. And that's the best you can do. And sometimes you have to live within the bounds in which you're stuck with, but, you know, make the best of it and figure out where to go from there.
100%. And with this, because we think this was a good topic. We're curious to know what everyone else thinks, right?
Yeah.
What environment do you work in? How are you working today? What kind of problems are you seeing? Are we crazy or do you agree with us? Agreeing with us 100% is no fun. Like our one friend, Dave, who likes to actually have conflict on LinkedIn. We want some conflict. We want to know that you disagree with us. We want to know that you have a different opinion or you have an even better idea. Other designs for the office or other ways of working that have helped you to be, you know, to go into a flow state or right, go into managing some deep work.
That's right. Yeah. So this was great. I always appreciate getting a chance to spend a couple hours talking and look forward to the next one, man.
Yeah, 100%. I appreciate the conversation, my friend, and enjoy your day.
Yeah. Cheers.
Cheers.